motion would be in order to approve the minutes of the last meeting. Do I hear such a motion? Representative Biskins moves that the minutes be approved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, nay. The motion carries. Member, I've got just one bit of information for you, and that is that Senate File 1064 will not be heard today. And it has been removed from the calendar. And the reason for that is that the fiscal aspect of the bill is not ready. And so because of that, that the bill will be heard at a later date.
I didn't hear Ms. Webster.
It is Senate File 1064. No, we took it off. And the reason for my explaining that to you, it's not on the agenda. It was taken off of the agenda, and so I was thinking that possibly there might be some people who would say, "Well, where is Senate File 1064?" I wanted to give you that information so that that is clarified. We have a number of bills today, I would like to call Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton, you can move your bill and kindly state your name for the record and the House file.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Representative Rod Hamilton of House File 1521. I'd like to move this bill to the General Register.
Okay. Would you begin with your testimony, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, basically what it does is it will extend the period under which a person can obtain a power limited technician's license. Of course, they have to pass the test and have a score of over 70% on the examination. The initial qualification was set when this license was originally instituted in the 2003 legislative session and expired June 30th of 2003. This bill would extend the initial qualification guidelines until September 30th of 2005. I'd like to point out that the bill in its original format did have some issues. We did work together with the Minnesota Electrical Association and also with the Minnesota Board of Electricity. During the first hearing, we did offer an amendment, and therefore everybody is on board and in support. There is a fiscal cost to this. It's a small one, but that's why we're here today. Basically, what it looks is once we get this up and rolling, we'll have it'll be revenue neutral, or there will be a fiscal impact of basically zero, bringing about $125,000 worth of revenue along with $125,000 worth of expenditures. However, there's about 2,000 individuals that will need to be notified. Working with the Minnesota Board of Electricity, they're willing to notify those individuals, so there's a cost of about $5,000. The Board of Electricity is willing to take on that cost to get this up and running to where we can notify everybody. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm open to any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, since this program is up and running already, is my understanding it's an extension of it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
Hamilton? Representative Solberg, that's correct, yes.
And,
Representative Solberg.
And, Mr. Chair, why is there a three-tenths of a person associated with that? Is that normal? Or maybe Mr. Marks?
Mr. Hamilton, would you kindly respond to the question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg. Like I said initially in my statement, there is going to take some time to get these individuals that will qualify under this extension notification. And so there will be an individual or individuals that will be working on that to make sure that people are notified of the extension, therefore they can come in and qualify under the extension.
Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chair, I haven't had a chance to study the fiscal note, but $125,000, many times most of that is in the personnel, and I'm wondering if I could apply for this job. Three-tenths of a person is $125,000. Can you give me...
A tenth of a person.
Can someone give me a little bit of explanation on the cost of other expenses?
Representative Hamilton, your response, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess my response is if you're wanting to apply for the job, we do have the individual out here that may be able to answer that question better than I can. Would it be okay, Mr. Chairman, to bring an individual forth to answer that question?
Yes, it would be. We would like that information.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir, would you kindly state your name for the record, and then if you would answer the question of Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Schultz. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Board of Electricity. Mr. Chair, committee members, the costs associated in FY06 relate to the administration of not only the applications, but also the examinations and the licensing process. In effect, it is the total cost for administering the examination process for approximately 2,000 or more applicants, as identified. The number of FTEs then is not a single individual, but a variety of individuals performing a number of different tasks.
Representative Solberg, to follow up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the cost of the exam is one thing, but your material for the exam and everything else is already done, is it not? It's already, you already have that material, correct?
Mr. Schultz?
Mr. Chairman, committee, that's true. However, there's a number of other costs associated. Again, it's broken down into a number of different areas. The one of the things that we learned during the 2002-2003 window was that it was necessary for us to rent additional space to administer the large number of examinations. We actually brought the examinations out to various areas within the state. We partnered with a number of different industry entities. I don't know the exact number, but during that time frame, I believe we were at over two dozen locations throughout Minnesota. Obviously, there's some additional costs associated with that, and those are all rolled up into this particular fiscal note.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
I don't have, none of that information is on this fiscal note. It's just merely a timing. Do you remember when we instituted the program what the fiscal note said?
Mr. Schultz?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, no, actually at the time that this original window went into effect back in 2002, we were actually anticipating there to be maybe 2,000 to 3,000 applicants. We ended up examining over 15,000 applicants. We were administering examinations as many as 6 days a week, as many as four locations each day, and in a number of instances, two exams per day. We actually administered, on two occasions, more examinations in North Dakota than North Dakota does in 1 year. We did that, obviously, working with the industry group up there. They had space available in Fargo, or else we wouldn't have gone to Fargo. We would have done it in Moorhead, which we did on a couple of other occasions. We're anticipating, again, about 2,000. However, it may be more than that, but we are prepared to do whatever it takes to meet the need of the constituents and the clientele.
Are there any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See, Mr. Schultz, if I remember right, in the beginning, wasn't there a relatively high passage rate for the test, and now we've gone to an extremely low rate? And where are we headed in the future?
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the initial bill going back to 2002 related to passing the alarm and communication examination, which was very limited in scope. After the expiration of that window of opportunity, the board developed an examination, the power limited technician examination, which is representative of the entire scope of work that's allowed under that license. Initially, applicants had a very difficult time passing that examination. However, since the pass rate has come up to approximately what it is for other types of license examinations that the board has administered for decades, or many, many decades for that matter, we would anticipate, again, that these applicants are going to do fairly well if they prepare themselves adequately. One of the reasons for changing the initial language was to put them into the power limited technician track, which even at the sunset of the application window, they are still within that track, and they can then, if they fail the examination, they can take the examination again because they've already been approved. So that was an important part that we recognized. We didn't want to end up with a situation that was similar to what happened in 2002, 2003, where there was an examination deadline on the back end. That caused a number of applicants to not adequately prepare and to rush themselves, obviously a much higher level of anxiety amongst those applicants. We believe this language will allow them to adequately prepare and not be faced with the expiration of the window and not be able to become licensed. This will allow them, as we move forward, to continue to retake the examination over time until such time that they can pass it if they so desire.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Schultz, what I was getting at is, if you made the test more realistic, I mean, a 7% pass rate, I would say the test was not realistic. If we adjusted the questions to, you're saying there's going to be more passing, so if the test become more realistic.
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, there was some modification made to the examination in late in 2003. Again, the applicants that have been taking that examination in recent months have been over 50%, or around 50% of those applicants have been passing that examination, which is very similar to examinations or pass rate for other examinations that the board administers, master electricians, journeyman electricians, etc.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just I guess just an informational question for myself. I remember when this was passed, was it 2004? The original language? 2002? Okay. Can you quickly, is it Mr. Schultz?
Mr. Schultz?
What was the problem we were trying to solve in the first place in 2002 with this legislation? What was the problem at that time?
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, committee member, the 2002 language actually expanded the scope of work that was previously allowed to be done under an alarm and communication contractor license. The scope of that work was very narrow and, in effect, required people who were doing somewhat similar work from a technology standpoint or from an electrical hazard standpoint to have a much higher level of license. It required, for example, people that were doing landscape irrigation type work or the electrical work related to that to be licensed as journeymen and master electricians and Class A contractors. This bill, back in 2002, expanded the scope of the then alarm and communication contractor license, renamed it technology system contractor license. The scope of work then was inclusive of all Class 2 and 3 type circuitry. Again, it was a significant change within the industry, but it actually changed the scope of work, and that's why it's somewhat different than what it used to be.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, then Representative Hamilton removes his motion to pass and be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion carries. Thank you, Representative.
you have to move it.
He keels over, we know why.
Next on the agenda will be House File, Senate File 1621. And I will move that particular amendment and or that particular bill. And it will be to be passed and placed on the general register. Representative Blaine, kindly begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Representative Greg Blaine, District 12B. Members, Senate File 1621 is a pretty straightforward piece of legislation. This comes before this body without a fiscal impact to the state of Minnesota, but the reason this bill is before you is actually to clarify what's in statute now for the Adjutant General's Office and Department of Military Affairs for activities that take place at Camp Ripley, which is in my district. Currently, Camp Ripley leases or rents buildings and facilities at Ripley to be used by various departments of the state and then also to local entities around Camp Ripley to be able to further utilize some of the facilities there. Some of the departments that utilize facilities at Camp Ripley include the DNR, the Department of Transportation, and Minnesota State Patrol. The Minnesota Peace and Police Officers also use some of the facilities out there in training. In kind of a glitch that was found by the State Auditor's Office with the language that was in statute, we wanted to clear the language up in an effort to continue to allow Camp Ripley to offer those facilities to others, and the revenue that is produced by the renting and leasing will continue to go to Ripley to maintain the facilities that they have there. And Mr. Chairman and members, that's Senate File 1621.
Okay. Are there any questions by any of the members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Silver.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hamilton, does this compete then with my groups or private businesses that are in the business of renting out conference centers and so forth?
Representative Blaine?
Representative Solberg, no, as you know, we discussed this in in the previous committee, and we're going to make sure that Camp Ripley does not pose a threat to the resorts in your area, and certainly the resorts and in other private business the rest of my district and across the state there. So,
follow up, Representative.
Mr. Chair, it does say that under current law, I think that they can rent to private entities and state agencies, and I'm a little concerned about that, but we'll be tracking that.
Representative Blaine,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, if we feel we need to make adjustments to the language in the bill as when we get to the floor, before we get to the floor, in discussions with the Senate authors, we'll be more than happy to do that. I know in the previous committee, in the State Government Finance Committee, we talked about that, and certainly the Department of Military Affairs is not interested in taking business away from private industry around the state or within the district.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Blaine. I know that there were some nonprofit organizations that used the facility for retreats, and they were donated the time and the space. will they now be required to pay for it, or will Camp Ripley still use it as a in-kind donation?
Representative Blair?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And,
excuse me,
and
Representative Blaine, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Representative Otremba, I really don't perceive, and I think I don't see anybody here from the Department of Military Affairs today, but I don't perceive there being any change in how business has been done at Ripley. Certainly there's no hidden agenda behind Senate File 1621 as far as changing what they're doing or trying to change the business structure that they've had in the past. And you're right, there has been organizations that have come out and used the facilities, including the Boy Scouts. As I testified in previous committees, too, we've had a number of private citizens who have used the chapel at Ripley for weddings, and certainly there are a number of funerals that take place, that services are conducted at the chapel there at Ripley. Ripley is, and the department is certainly not looking for any kind of advantage or a change in how they've done business there. It's strictly, I think, Senate File 1621 is here strictly to pacify the state auditor's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would either be wanted to make a comment either for or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, then Representative Blaine moves to pass Senate File 1621. I've just been informed that because I moved the bill, I am the one that has to do so. So Representative Dempsey moves to pass Senate File 1621 and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion carries. Thank you, Representative Blaine, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 1964. I will move House File 1964 to be passed and to be placed on the General Register. Representative Peterson, welcome to the committee. And kindly begin your testimony with your name and then the information we need in regard to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I have two gentlemen with me from the Department of Administration. They're both from the Energy Management Services, Mr. Rajan Thomas and Mr. Ed Robinson, who are here to answer any questions you may have. This is a simple bill. It's an energy-forward pricing tool to lock in future prices of state agencies and to limit the exposure of price volatility. And it also extends the guaranteed energy savings agreements to 15 years. We have been through government ops, government finance, and the Senate companion has moved to the floor. We are here to answer any questions you may have.
Would you care to have one of your members come forward and testify, or
they will answer questions. We can take as long or as little time as you want, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Are there any questions from the members of the committee? Are there any questions? Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I haven't even had a chance to look at the bill. I just think I should know a little bit more about it before I vote on it. I heard you say something about locking in long-term
right.
agreements, I guess.
Agreements.
I mean, on the one hand, I know that there can be a lot of savings if there's a low price and it's locked in. It can be very, very helpful. What happens if it's a high price? And do they all go towards 15 years? Mm-hmm. I think I heard that here.
With California?
So are we kind of doing a guaranteed profit to some of those high price years or what?
This is, again,
Representative Robinson, please.
Excuse me. I would like to have you go through the committee chair, please. Mr. Peterson, are you going to
Mr. Chairman, I will refer the question to Mr. Ed Robinson.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson, kindly state your name for the record and then answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I'm Ed Robinson with the Department of Administration, and we work in a small group called the Energy Management Section. As the question was stated, I think I should back up because it sounds like there was some confusion as to Section 1 of the House file and Section 2. Section 1 of the House file provides us with the authorization to do forward price contracting for utilities, in particular natural gas, and excluding electricity, by the way. We can't guarantee that our forward pricing contracts will make money for the state every year, but we do think in the long run it will, multiple years. It allows us to lock in a price for natural gas for a portion of what our projected needs are. And that's both for Department of Administration and other state agencies and MNSCU. We would administer those contracts for all those agencies. And typically a contract would be for 1 year. On Section 2, we already have a guaranteed savings contract system in place, and it allows us to go out 10 years, and we're requesting to go out 15 years. And the way it works is the energy retrofit, we put together programs for energy retrofits in various agencies and facilities, and the savings, the utility savings from installing those projects is sufficient to make the payment, the lease purchase payment that's required to pay off the project.
Representative Fulbert. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the Section 1, and as your testimony stated, you're doing a portion of your projected need, but I look at line 25 and 26, and it says not to exceed the estimated energy use for the state agency for the same period. That's not a portion. That's the whole ball of wax. And my thought here is the portion is a better idea because that encourages not using everything up. That encourages conservation, but when you say not to exceed the estimated energy use for the agency, that means you are planning, you're building in no conservation. So I hearing this contrast between what you said and what I'm reading in the bill. Help me out here.
Mr. Robbins?
Robinson. Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, yeah, it's our intention in the procedures and policies to be promulgated under this that we lock ourselves in basically to 60% of what we think our future needs are.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but that's not what this language says. This language says 100%, essentially, because it says not to exceed. And it seems to me you should statutorily tell us what you're really intending. And it would be helpful, I think, if the language said not to exceed 90% of or 60% of or whatever number you are intending to use, because this looks like no conservation.
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, we put that in there as an absolute safety net that we don't go off the deep end and contract for two or three times what we would normally need.
24 months. You mean 24 months?
Well, and the reason why this is stated as 24 months is that it takes some time to get a contract put together, and the contract will typically be a 12-month contract.
Representative Wagenius.
I think we're passing like ships in the night. Your testimony was that you're contracting for a portion of the need and that is your intention. That sounds good to me because that allows us some conservation leeway and some encouragement to do conservation, particularly if we're in a rising price market. But your language is different. Your language is at 100%. And it seems to me that a good amendment here would be something like not to exceed 90% of or 60% of or whatever your intention is here.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, we would be amenable to a 90% limit. I think that gives us enough flexibility to work in some conservation. And I would say that the main function of this is budget protection. That was essentially what the bill was written around.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, I understand it's budget protection, but you were also testifying with the conservation hat on, too. And I would just ask the author if he would be interested in amending the language. I'm certainly not going to do it. I know how to count votes in this committee. And so it would take the author to say that he would want to change the language.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, yes, I'm hearing from my constituents here that 90% would be considered a friendly amendment if you would like to add that text.
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to amend this language to say not on line 25, not to exceed 90% of the...
Okay, so page 1, line 25, Wagenius moves after the word exceed, not 90% of?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does council have that amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Discussion to the Wagenius oral amendment to page 1, line 25, after the word exceed, insert 90% of. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the Guinness oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Wagenius, I have a hard time seeing you over everyone sometimes. Okay, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, I need to have some understanding of going from 10 years to 15 years. And there's many times the kind of equipment that I understand that you're purchasing is a type of equipment that is a cost saving, but it's heating and cooling type equipment, and that type of sort of you want a payback. But sometimes they don't last. The 10-year payoff is important. I need to have some testimony on why we're going to 15 years on this.
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg. 10 years has allowed us to do what's commonly referred to as the low-hanging fruit, lighting, and some very minor changes in HVAC control and operation. 15 years would allow us to do more in the control and HVAC portions of the energy saving retrofits. As a matter of our internal policy, we always watch and make certain that the payback time frame for this equipment does not exceed its useful life.
Representative,
well, Mr. Chairman, with that I can understand it. It does say shall not exceed, but sometimes I think you have to be careful on what type of salesperson you are calling on you for those, because I've seen some programs instituted and they were out before they're paid for.
Okay. Representative Greiling, Anderson, and Biskins. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I'm just looking on page 2 of the fiscal note. Bill description, section 1 up there at the top, the last line in section 1. It says the primary purpose of the bill is to limit the exposure to pricing volatility, not to save money. I wondered if you would comment on that.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll refer to Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greiling. Yes, we did write the bill expressly with the intention to take price volatility, take the impact of price volatility out of the budgeting process. We do believe, as I said, that over 3, 4, 5 years, there will be a significant cost savings, but in any single given year, there could be, we certainly hope, a small penalty.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember working on some legislation with energy-saving contracts for schools several years back, and one of the things that concerned me about this type of contract, and I'd be very concerned now to move from 10 to 15 years, but one thing that concerned me, and I'm wondering how this applies to this bill, was the fact that the contractor, the person, the company who was doing the energy saving contracts, was also the one determining if any money had been saved, and the way that anyone else would check, like an independent engineer who lived in the district who wanted to make sure there was money for schools, was not allowed to see that data because it was proprietary information.
Well, I hope so.
And I'm wondering if that would be the case with these as well.
Mr. Roberts, our Representative
Chairman,
Peterson.
So the question is, who determines the savings? Is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative... Peterson, yes, and also, or Mr. Robinson, and also if the information can be viewed so others can have a cross-check on that, on how much is saved.
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greiling, yes, in the energy audit, the contractor does that energy audit and does determine the savings, and then that audit is given over to us in energy management. And we go over it line by line and make sure that there are no shenanigans in there. I would say that we argue with the contractors regularly about what language should be in the contract. One of the few things that we are able to agree on consistently is the need to go to 15 years from 10. But, excuse me, I think I missed part of your question, the latter part of the term.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robinson, the last part is this information public?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greiling, at the point in time when the contract is signed with the contractor, that becomes a public document. That becomes a public document subject to all the parts of the Data Practices Act. We haven't seen any stipulations put in these audits that would preclude a third party, if you will, from coming in and looking at it.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, are you extending any contracts?
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, No, and we won't extend any existing contracts. Those have been done under the 10-year limitation. It's only future contracts where we could include more energy savings opportunities.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're kind of running over stuff that probably were covered in the policy people that were looking at this. We got a $5,000 cost to this that's going to be absorbed by the agency. Why are we fiddling with this bill?
Mr. Robinson. Or Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Nalbach, I think they're legitimate questions, and there's concern. I think we've seen episodes over the last years in California and other states where these questions need to be asked.
Am I going
to
get my bill?
They're helpful.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hart.
Are we, isn't there a de minimis on the amount of money that we look at, especially when it's not going to be a state cost except indirectly? It's already absorbed in the budget.
Representative Earhart, these days the de minimis amount, given our budget situation, is what everyone around the table is willing to contribute out of their own wallets.
Well,
I think Representative Earhart, it is a small amount. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Chairman, and besides that, you're running for Congress, so I can understand that. That you've got to be as prudent as possible.
I won't go there, Representative Earhart. Representative Riccovina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, I'm kind of puzzled because I'm looking at the bill and on page 2, on line 36, they added new language after inflation adjustments have been made. And then further on page 3 and 25, number H is inflation adjustments means adjusting the operation and maintenance cost savings baseline annually for inflation. But yet, Representative Oblak, you don't do that with the budget. You don't adjust it for inflation on the spending side at all. So since you don't adjust that for inflation, why would we'd be doing it in this cost-saving measure?
Well,
remember, there is no inflation when it comes to cost anymore.
Well, Representative Riccovina, as I understand it, this bill is written partly to enable us to avoid the inflation cost.
That's one thing
we could do.
Oh, so then what's going on in this bill is we're carrying on the scam saying that gas prices don't go up, so you can adjust it for inflation. I'm reading it the exact opposite way, but perhaps you were giving me a good education on the continuing saga of pretending things don't go up in price.
Well, things go up, things go down. I guess all I see on this in terms of the fiscal note is a very small fiscal note, Representative Riccovina. Okay, is there any other discussion on House File 1964? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Dempsey renews his motion that House File 1964 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, Representative Peterson and Mr. Robinson. Next, we have House File 814, Representative Cornish.
814.
Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee, Representative Cornish. Chair, I'll move that House File 814 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 814 is an agency bill, the DNR's Omnibus Lands Bill. And included in there is a number of different positions of descriptions of sale of the state land transfers, number of policy issues. There's, I think, three separate bills in here from three separate members of your committee to do with land exchanges. And, Mr. Chairman, rather than go through each of the typical land exchanges that's been covered in the three previous committees, the land subcommittee, the full environment policy, and then environment finance. I understand there's probably a section of the bill which brings it to this committee, which is the fiscal notes and the fiscal, the handling of the appropriation here, or I should say the land sale. Would it be okay just to move into that?
That would be just fine, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman Nomblock and members, I would introduce Paul Pojar from the DNR, the lands and minerals person, and he will go into the handling of the money that received from the sale of these lands.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Paul Pojar. I work for the Department of Natural Resources, the Lands and Minerals section. We have five parcels of land in this bill that are state-owned parcels. We provided information for a fiscal note. Our estimate for the revenue that would be generated from the sale of these five parcels is approximately $48,000. There are probably 18 to 20 additional parcels of land that are in this omnibus bill, and those are lands that were the request was made by, from individual counties, and I have no information on the revenue that would be generated from those counties, sale of tax forfeited land, but I would assume if they're selling the land, it's going to be for a profit rather than a loss.
Okay, any discussion? The House File 814. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, I'm a little concerned here because I see that there's one, two, four pieces of land being public property being sold in Hennepin County, and I'm wondering, you know, if my fellow representatives from Hennepin County are concerned that we're selling land, because I know if it was in any other part of the state north of Hinckley, we'd be jumping out of our skin here to find out what's going on. So, Representative Cornish, is this going to be scored as an environmental vote? Because this could be one of the most important votes I take this year for the environment, selling public waters in Hennepin County. I'm extremely nervous about voting on this today.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I think I'll let Mr. Pojar answer that.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Pojar.
Representative Rukavina, the lands are being sold to local units of government for flood control purposes. They are tax forfeited lands that the county currently manages, and they would be passed on to cities like the city of Minnetrista, is one that I recall being involved.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
Pojar, on page 3, where we're selling land to the city of Minnetrista on Lake Minnetonka, I mean, is this for an access, or?
Mr. Chairman,
Pojar.
Representative Rukavina, my understanding is that all four of these are for flood control purposes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pojar, are there any public accesses now on Lake Minnetonka? Is there finally a public access there?
Mr.
Pojar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, yes.
Oh, okay. Just checking on. Well, Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Wagenius or Representative Clark could assure me that this is okay to sell public land in Hennepin County, because I'm, you know, a little nervous. Representative Greiling told us how important environment votes are this morning in Congress. So,
Mr. Kojar, do you have any information as to the tax assessed value of these properties? I'm assuming if they're for flood control purposes that they must not be very high.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's some it addresses the assessed value in the fiscal note. There is some statement there about the it's going to be done on a county level, or the all they've done it so far, I believe the evaluation was like a map evaluation, and said the actual market value ultimately be found to vary. It's going to be done at the county level before the sale.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, is there any scientific and natural areas that are unique to the individual tracts of land?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, do you anywhere in the bill, Mr. Anderson, or do you mean the Hennepin County that we were talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the whole bill.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there is a section here addressing scientific and natural areas, but I'll let Mr. Pojar answer that.
Mr. Chairman, Pojar. Representative Anderson, there are no scientific and natural areas involved with the lands that are identified for potential sale. There is a section, however, dealing with scientific and natural areas, and that's more of a policy-related issue, and it deals with how we at the DNR go about purchasing lands for inclusion in the scientific and natural area program. And it would involve working with the counties so that there is a full understanding on their part of what we are doing, what we are proposing.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, it looks like we're repealing the entire section where the counties have a say in the designation of said lands. Is there any other part of law that gives the county some protection from the DNR actually playing God in this issue and going ahead and designating outside of the county's wishes?
Mr. Kodar.
Mr. Chair, while he's looking that up,
Representative Cornish
and Representative Biskins, I believe the repeal we're talking about was an agreement made to previously, and I believe also that there is language now that mandates the procedures be the same for wetlands as for wildlife management purposes, but I don't know if that addresses the scientific areas. I'll let Mr. Pojar answer that.
Mr. Pojar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. As I understand it, the current law required that before the designation of a scientific and natural area took place, the county was given the opportunity to review and approve this. The problem that creates is that it involves the land after the sale has been conducted, the negotiations have taken place, and we have already, in effect, told the owner of the land that we're going to buy the land, and the transactions have already taken place, and the money for those acquisitions has been approved by the legislature. And so we're in a position where the county could say before designation took place, but after we had purchased the land, no to the designation. It puts us in an awkward position. We've already spent state money on this piece of land, and the restrictions in how we use that money is to use it for scientific and natural purposes. What this would do would be to, what this bill would do would be to have a review at one point in time prior to us getting involved with the purchase of the land. In other words, we would come to the county and say we would like to proceed with creating a scientific and natural area on parcel A. We would then get approval by the county and then come to the legislature for money to actually purchase the land.
Representative Otremba.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to be clear, because I know that my county commissioners are extremely upset because the DNR comes and actually takes the land and there's no conversation. And it's a pretty hot topic out in rural Minnesota. So what you're saying is this language, does it require you to come in front of the county commissioners before you make that decision, or is it just suggested that you could do that?
Mr. Pojar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it requires us to go before the county to seek their approval before we get involved with the purchase of land that would be designated or that we want to designate as a scientific and natural area.
And, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lacremba.
And if they say no, then that's it?
That's
Mr. Cogart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Chair, I'm just wondering, Mr. Pojar, the language on page 9 and following on page 10 regarding St. Louis County, and it's the 150-foot easement being required in D on page 9, and then in E they talk about a 75-foot strip, and E and F, and in G again the state 150-foot easement. What's going on there?
Mr. Pojar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, those dimensions, those distances were all worked out between the county and our field people. In some cases, it may be a stream, a trout stream, and they want a certain distance either side to allow the public access to the trout stream. I don't know specifically what the various different dimensions are attempting to do here, but it was something that was worked out between the county and the DNR local people.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
how come that isn't in the language, let's say, for Hennepin County?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, my assumption would be that our people met with the county and took a look at the areas and found that there was no need for access to these areas. I would assume, since Hennepin County's lands are going to be used for flood control, they're lowlands, wetlands, and probably access to those areas is not necessary or needed by the public.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, in all of these transactions in 814, we made sure that they were non-controversial and they had the input from the local governmental units that were there. So, and there was no testimony against the provisions of these separate sections in the three previous committee hearings.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Anderson.
Has there been any private deals made?
Representative Cornish.
Could you state the question again, Representative Anderson?
How about a private buyer? Has he made an offer yet?
Representative Cornish, Mr. Porger.
Not blocked, and Representative Anderson, Mr. Porger might know the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there's been no negotiations with regard to the actual sale of these. On the five pieces of land that the department is proposing for sale, we have been approached by adjacent owners and with a request that these lands be put up for sale. We've reviewed the lands, found them to be surplus, and are going to make them available. What the process would be at this point would be to, if we receive the approval of the legislature, would be to appraise the land, come up with a value for that land, and that's the minimum amount that we would find to be acceptable for the sale of those parcels.
Representative Anderson.
Well, if a person offered a higher price, would you take that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, yes.
It's an environmental loan.
Is there any other discussion to House File 814? He said yes. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 814 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Mahoney.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair will move that House File 400 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 400 affects three different school districts, the Norwood Young America, Chaska, and North Branch food service employees. This is a total of 125 people. They have, every 2 years we've had to come here to get session law that allows them to collect unemployment insurance for the 2 months that they are not employed by the school district. They like their job. They intend to go back to their job in August when school starts up again. And it is rather impossible for them to find a job for those 8 weeks during the summer. We're trying to change this into the law so that we don't have to come back every couple of years to allow them to collect unemployment. Back in 98, it became only if an employer, up until 98, it was if an employer objected. And for 20 years prior to that, no employer objected to paying them their 8 weeks worth of unemployment. I don't know, and neither does, I haven't been able to find out what changed that particular law in 98. We've had to come back every 2 years, and we unanimously in all the committees allowed them to collect their 8 weeks worth of unemployment. I just ask that the committee save on a workload in 2 years by not forcing us to come back and go through this process again.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mahoney. Are there any questions regarding the bill? Is there anyone in the audience that would care to speak on behalf or in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Knobloch removes his motion for House File 400 be passed.
Mr. Chair, I guess Representative Mahoney, I just have one question. Does this add in any way to the costs of the school district?
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, to my knowledge, no. The department says no. The school district has not implied that it did. They've not bothered. This is the same thing we've been doing for more than 20 years. So it should not add or subtract anything from the school district.
Okay, thanks.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, it doesn't add to the school district's costs, but the employer's cost of unemployment insurance will increase if those employees draw benefits for 8 weeks every summer. So if the employer's cost of business increases, the price that he's going to charge to the school district, you would be led to believe, would increase. Would that not be true?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. Actually, the employer has been paying this for, as I said, over 20 years. The school district employees have been collecting these 8 weeks worth of unemployment for over 20 years. So there will be no change. The employer's rates should not change other than any normal employer or employee inflation decrease or increase. So I don't see how, and as I said, no one that I've talked to has been able to tell me that there's going to be an increase.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Mahoney, that's absolutely wrong. No, this employer's unemployment insurance rates, if they're collecting 8 weeks of insurance or 8 weeks of unemployment benefits, his experience mod will be higher long-term if they collect 8 weeks of benefits than if they don't. Whether that cost will be passed on to the school district or not, I don't know what all other work they're doing, but I think it is, in all honesty, we have to be very forthright here that this employer's unemployment insurance costs, which can be a substantial cost of doing business, can be up to 10% of the cost of wages for somebody like in the business that I was formerly in landscape contracting, very seasonal. It can be up to 10% the cost of wages. So
this would potentially, or it will be, a cost of their doing business if they continue to do this. If it didn't happen in the future, their cost of business would go down, and they conceivably could be more competitive.
Representative McNamara, I assume that is a statement and not a question. Am I correct?
That's true, and I'm done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Cleansing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I was wondering, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, and maybe Representative McNamara does, but what? How consistent is this particular policy with how other seasonal jobs are treated? And I bring it up, too, because I know teachers who get laid off and aren't necessarily allowed to collect unemployment over the summer if it's found that they can get a job by the next year. So if you get laid off in April, and, I mean, this has happened, I know, in a charter school where they were laid off in April and they weren't allowed to collect unemployment for the summer. They weren't allowed to start collecting until fall. So I guess I'm wondering how consistent this policy is with other seasonal jobs like construction, et cetera, because it seems inconsistent with how teachers can be treated at times.
Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to call up someone from the department, but I suspect that in many cases it is how the contract is written for whether it's a food service person or a teacher, generally it's a one-year contract, and you could take your payment over 9 months or over 12 months, much like we do ours. We work 6 months a year here, or five or six, but our income is stretched out over 12. But let me bring up someone from the department to answer both yours and Representative McNamara's question. Mr.
No.
Sir, would you kindly state your name for the record, and then if you would answer the questions of Mr. McNamara and of Representative Cleansing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Mr. Chairman, members, it's fairly complex. I wish I could just give you an easy, simple answer. The law does provide for certain provisions regarding seasonal employees. Minnesota has a special provision regarding seasonal employees in the tourist and recreation industry. Minnesota also has a provision for non-professional school employees. As to school, professional employees of the school district, federal law requires that they not collect unemployment benefits in the summer months if they have a job to return to in the fall. That is required by federal law. That is the only thing which is required by federal law applies to teachers and other professionals. As to non-professionals, Minnesota has chosen to deny non-professionals of a school district during the summer months, and that has been in the law since the early 70s. As to contract workers, this particular provision involves private contractors have a contract with the school district to provide the services the school district could otherwise provide had they chosen to do so. Minnesota put that in 1983, I believe. However, had some specific provisions, as Representative Mahoney has indicated, which essentially allowed the employer to choose whether the people could collect or not. These particular workers have always collected unemployment benefits. Those are the only provisions regarding seasonal employees in the law. Otherwise, a seasonal employee is not restricted from collecting. Minnesota did have some more broader seasonality provisions in the late 70s, and had chosen to repeal those. But otherwise, there are no restrictions on seasonal employees collecting benefits other than school district workers and some very specific provisions involving private contracts with school districts. Otherwise, seasonal employees collect benefits in Minnesota.
Representative Cleansing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this 12-year contract thing keeps getting brought up, but I'm talking about teachers who are laid off in April with no job to go to whose contract's not been fully paid. So they did not get their full 12 years of pay, or 12 months of pay, excuse me, for the year. And they were denied unemployment because they had the potential of being able to start a job in the fall, but there was no contract set. And it sounds like you said if there is a job to return to in the fall, no one in unemployment would be paid. And it sounds to me like that's the situation of these food service workers, too, that they do have a job to go to in the fall. And they kind of know what they're signing up for from the get-go. So I'm kind of trying to understand what the distinguishing factor is here.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the law provides that a professional of a school district and or charter school, the University of Minnesota, private colleges and public colleges, it's very broad. When I say public school, I mean any school. The law provides that if you have a reasonable assurance of returning in the fall, now that can be by custom. It doesn't have to mean a signed contract. It just means a reasonable assurance. Do you expect to return in the fall? Does the school expect you to return? Then you are denied in the summer. As I say, that's required by federal law. As to other provisions, let's say Minnesota in 1983 adopted this particular provision but has always had an exception, and this bill seeks to have that exception made permanent.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's very important to note that the employer is the one that asked for this. These employees that he has working in cafeterias, that is a contracted business that is dead out. The employer knows and has asked for them to collect unemployment insurance so we won't lose those people after the very short period of time that they are not working. And that's why this provision has been coming to this institution for as long as it has. Hopefully after this bill passes, if it does, that we won't have to see it again.
Representative Mahoney, comment?
That was actually my next comment, so I want to thank Representative Gunther for bringing it up. It's been in front of his committee and the Commerce Committee and gone over this a number of times.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really trying to not have to beleaguer this point, but Representative Mahoney, is the employer here in the audience today?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, no, the employer has stated that they're very comfortable with this particular provision going in. They don't want to have to object or have anything to do with it. They put it into their bid and
been here.
The cost of doing business to them. They want to keep their trained employees coming back in August.
Representative Baird.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, or maybe Representative Gunther, whichever. So you're saying then that this applies to this one instance where we have a private contractor contracting with the school district, or does this put all school districts in Minnesota under this new provision?
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baird. This portrays itself to just these 125 employees of three different school districts. So the Norwood, Young America, Chaska, and North Branch districts.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, that are employed by this employer as a private contractor doing this business.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, let me restate that. It would cover all private contractors for school districts. I'm not sure if there are others that would be affected by this bill other than these three that have come to us time and time again. Now let me ask the testifier here, Mr. Nelson, if he knows of any others that it might affect.
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. Very few workers. We don't know, we don't have a way of tracking how many of these people because it's we don't even ask them, but we do know the number is very small. Two or three other times in the past, it's well known. The employers involved in this area have known, and like I say, these people have been paid for 20 years. They're well aware of this particular provision. The exception to this provision is very well known.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but it's this legislation earmarks everybody working in the food service business, where we have had an exclusion for one employer in the past. We are now opening it up for every school district to contract out, and those contractors' employees will now be eligible for unemployment and benefits, whereas current law, if they're school district employees, they are not eligible for unemployment and benefits. This clearly, I would say, is going to extend privatization to our food service of the school districts, because it will allow those employers the advantage of having those employees collect unemployment if they want to structure their work this way, to where they lay them off in the summertime. This bill is not only for this one company.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara. This bill has been out there for 20 years. This exemption has been out there for 20 years or better. So everyone in this particular field has known about this exemption, if not for 20 years, at least for the last 6 or 10 years. There are these 125 at the current time that take advantage of it with no complaint from their employer. It has been there for any other private company to take advantage of. This has been something that any bidder for any place in any other school district could take advantage of. No one has taken advantage of. I can't imagine that if it's been there for 20 years and no one's taken advantage of it, there's going to be a rush to take advantage of it.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, on your bill, on page 19, it says the employer and an elementary or secondary school. How do you define secondary school?
I think that's line 19.
Line 19, I'm sorry. Line 19.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dempsey. I'm going to define a secondary school as either a middle school or a senior high, but if you want to do something different, that would be the two schools that I think would come underneath that wording.
Okay,
Representative Dempsey.
Are you sure that's the case?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dempsey, unless you can show me some other or give me some other example, I can't imagine any other scenario, but maybe you know something that I don't.
Representative Dempsey.
Mr. Chairman, inserted on line 19 of page 1, it could be elementary, comma, middle, or secondary school.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney,
and Representative Dempsey, in current law, we've had, if you go up to line 12 on page 1, that's the language that's been in current law for an extended period of time. Certainly, if that is comfort language for you, it could be put in there, but I don't know that it's needed.
Representative Dempsey, I wonder what we could do here is, assuming the bill does pass, maybe we can look at that in between now and the floor, and if there's some language change that's necessary there, that could be a floor amendment. Would that be acceptable?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion of House File 400? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 400 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sertich here. Representative Sertich is here. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, Representative Sertich. The chair will move that House File 898 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. This bill, House File 898, deals with the SUTA Dumping Prevention Act of 2004. It was a federal act. SUTA stands for State Unemployment Tax Act. That's kind of fitting that we just dealt with the bill dealing similarly with that. The federal act was done under the Bush administration, and both bodies voted unanimously for it. What happens is, as President McNamara discussed, about experience ratings. There are some businesses in Minnesota that develop shell companies, move their employees around to dodge their experience ratings, which is harmful for all the other businesses that are doing the right thing and not evading their taxes. So this bill puts us in compliance with that. I have the honor and privilege of spending many a summer day on the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Task Force, which is probably one of the sexiest task forces. Chair Gunther and I sit there and enjoy ourselves discussing unemployment insurance with the Chamber of Commerce, AFL-CIO, and other organizations. We've come to agreement on what bills move forward, and this is the bill that moved forward. What it does, it provides penalties for companies that are avoiding their taxes, and the fiscal impact basically is very minimal of running this through the special fund that is designated for unemployment insurance. With that, I'd answer any questions.
Questions for Representative Sertich? You said you and Representative Gunther enjoy yourselves? All right.
Absolutely.
It's like watching wallpaper paste dry, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. No discussion. Seeing no discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 898 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Mr. Chairman, member.
Why don't, well, we're, I was going to go slightly out of order here, but I think we can still get these two bills done. I'll take Representative Sikora's bill, which is, I think, pretty much just a technical bill. Representative Sikora moves that House File 2335 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the forecast adjustments. So this is looking at what we had planned to spend in 04-05, and then depending on the number of students, et cetera, in various places in this bill, that spending changed somewhat. So that's essentially what it is. So if you take a look at it, for instance, page one, general education aid, gives you a number that was forecast, that was spent in 04, and then if you look at 05, we ended up spending more in 05.
Discussion to House File 2335. Seeing no discussion, Representative Sikora renews her motion that House File 2335 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
The next and last bill on the calendar for the day is House File 952, Representative Finstead. Representative Finstead, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The chair will move that House File 952 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Positive Alternatives Act, House File 952. And it is, to sum it up, it is, this bill appropriates money, $2.5 million, to the Commissioner of Health to make competitive grants available to those organizations that are providing referrals and services to women that encourage and assist them in carrying their pregnancies to full term. It is the bill calls for $2.5 million in fiscal year 2007, $50,000 in 2006 to the Commissioner of Health to get the program established and started, and then it also says of the $2.5 million, $100,000 may be used for administrative purposes through the department. That is the very quick overview. I have Andrew Rao with MCCL here with me if there's questions or concerns.
Okay, members, the bill is here primarily, of course, for the fiscal discussion. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick questions. Are these programs, I'm not that familiar with them, but are they licensed? That would be question number one. And number two, are there medical personnel at these clinics?
Sure.
Representative Finstead?
We do have someone from the Department of Health here that could respond. Otherwise, Ms. Rao would respond.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, there's not a specific kind of program that's in place, like you have to follow steps A, B, and C in order to be an abortion alternatives program. There are many, many programs throughout the state already that exist. Our guess is around 100 programs that are out there that are providing these services to women. The basic understanding is, and it is outlined in the bill, but any organization that is providing real alternatives for women, providing referrals for what may be health care, medical care in particular, nutrition services, housing, employment, basically any need that a woman has during her pregnancy in order to help her have a healthy outcome and help her to bring the child to term and provide a better life for both of them. As far as whether or not there is any medical staff on site, it depends on the program. The programs really vary substantially from program to program and provide different services. And so if they are providing any kind of direct medical services, then yes, certainly medical staff are on staff.
Representative Paynar,
wondering if these grants are made available, it seems to me that some of the requirements should be that they be licensed with the state and that, I mean, this is just, seems to me a bit irresponsible that we don't have any licensing procedure for these clinics. I mean, some of them can provide medical care. They don't have to. If they do provide medical care, are they licensed? Are the medical care employees licensed with the state in some way? I mean, nowhere in the bill does it even mention that.
Representative Pinstead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the bill, it outlines various different programs that would qualify for this, not just necessarily medical care, from parental care, nutrition information assistance, housing assistance, adoption services, education, employment assistance. I think we're looking for the Department of Health to give us some leadership as they define the criteria for these grants. If they're giving grants on the basis of medical care, I would assume then that the department would have the criteria in place that they'll need to meet X, Y, and Z to qualify for the medical care portion of the grant.
But, Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymark,
where does it say that the Department of Health will do that? I'm just trying to...
Mr. Chair, we have someone from the Department of Health that would like to...
All right. Someone from the department is coming forward.
And it says it under Subdivision 2 that the Department of Health will award grants, but... doesn't talk about
Subdivision 3.
Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Yes, thank you. My name is Carol Wolverton. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health with oversight of the Bureau of Community and Family Health Promotion. When we do, in answer to your question, Mr. Chair and Representative, when we do RFPs, we would outline what would be the qualifications in order to get those dollars. Medical care, what we would be looking for is if they do provide it on site, that there are certain qualifications that they would follow in providing that, that it would be a licensed physician or nurse practitioner or an individual qualified to provide that care as part of the RFP. But the other piece would be if they're going to refer to medical service, that would be an opportunity to get them on a public or private program if they are not already doing so. So it's an additional link and opportunity, I think, and we would put that as part of the grant process.
So, Mr. Chair, that'll be in the RFP. It's not anywhere in the bill regarding my...
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Wolverton.
It isn't in the bill, but it would be an understanding that if they were going to provide that, we would, as the Department of Health, make sure that those qualifications in providing that would be met.
Representative Bradley to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 points. On the question about medical practice, our laws are very clear that you're required under licensing scopes of practice to not practice medicine without the proper license, so anybody in violation of that would be in violation of current law. On the other point, if you look at the top of page 4, which is in subdivision 3, it says, Commissioner shall monitor and review the programs of each grantee to ensure that the grantee carefully adheres to the purposes and requirements of subdivision 2 and shall cease funding a grantee that fails to do so. That's probably more careful than we are in most of our grants, actually.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinstead,
I've asked this question in a number of committees on different bills, and I'll have to ask it with you on ways and means it's appropriate. Where do you get the money to pay for this program? It's $2.5 million.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is in the targets that were passed on House Floor in the Health Human Service budget. And as far as where specifically, I guess it's just making a priority of where we spend our money. And in my eyes, this is targeting money to the most vulnerable citizens of the state. So I think it's, and that would be the unborn. And I would say that is the short and quick answer, but it is in the Health and Human Service target that we passed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina.
The money for the spill specifically is in the health?
Representative Rukavina, yes. This will, as a health item, this will have to be carried on the health spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair, and I realize that. Representative Finstead, what programs under Ms. Wolverton's community and family health promotion will be eliminated in order to pay for this, I guess, would be the next way to put it. Anyway, I'm sticking up for you.
Ms. Wolverton, welcome back to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, there are no programs that are being eliminated from the Community and Family Health Program. This will be in addition to any currently existing programs.
So, Representative Rukavina, Ms. Wolverton, you're telling me that your budget will have no cuts in it and it will be at $2.5 million a year more. The next few years.
Ms. Wolverton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, the budget as set forth in the by the governor for the health department does have some cuts within that particular budget.
Could you tell me what they are, ma'am?
From the Community and Family Health Bureau, the cuts are the suicide prevention grants.
Oh.
We have also...
The living kids we don't care about, but the ones that still aren't born yet, we seem to care more. Mr. Chair and Representative Finstead, I might add that $88,000 has been cut from the suicide prevention program just in my little corner of the world. $88,000. And I got a call this weekend from a lady that told me they prevented. They believe all of this money, there's been no environment, no administrative costs on it. And so that's the kind of program we're cutting. And you know, with the suicides that... and the problem that's out there, and we just had, a few up north where it's kind of like a copycat deal, and that's what they're trying to address. So, see, money does not grow on trees, members. And so you cut an excellent program like that in order to start one. I care about the unborn as much as anybody does. But I care, you know, I think it's much more of an impact on a parent to lose a child. And for those that have had, you know what I'm talking about, that you've nurtured and grown with, and you're, they've got the personality that you know and you've existed with, than it is to kind of worry about the concerns of the unborn at this point. I think we should look at that. Ms. Wolverton, could you tell me any other? I never let you get past that program, so tell me a few more just that are being cut by the governor.
Another cut out of my particular bureau is the, and it's not a cut, we are shifting the dental health program off of general fund. We're moving that over into our health program, loan forgiveness program. So it will join that pocket of dollars. So it's more of a shift rather than a cut. And that's out of my particular bureau.
Thank you. Give me just a few more ideas for fodder for the floor before we...
I can. If I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, go back to your response around the suicide prevention grant dollars, is that those grant dollars we did, those are being cut. But however, right now, we're in the process of writing two federal grants for suicide prevention. One of them is the Garrett Lee Smith Act, and we are working very closely with SAVE and Yellow Ribbon and our current grantees, as well as the Department of Human Services, in order to make that a viable application for dollars from at the federal level. We are also pursuing, through our Maternal Child Health Block Grant, dollars around suicide and postpartum depression with mothers. And so those are two opportunities that we're going after to replace the general fund grant dollars, which would be cut.
Chair. Okay, Representative Rukavina. I've also got Representatives Greiling, Beard, and Diskins.
Ms.
Representative Rukavina.
Correct me if I'm wrong, please, but there's no guarantee that you will get any grant monies from the federal government. There's just a possibility. You've applied, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, we have applied, and Minnesota does have a very good history in acquiring those federal grants. But there is no guarantees.
Representative Greiling, I thought I saw your hand up. Did you have your hand up?
I'm often confused with Representative Clark, and this is another occasion.
Well, I probably saw a hand up next to yours, and it was Representative Clark. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to ask this to, perhaps a person from the Health Department. You know, this is quite an array of services that could be offered. And I'm just wondering, because I can think of people right now who are, you know, struggling with their child care assistance or struggling with their housing or struggling with their medical care. And, you know, if they could go over and take on this program, to pick up those costs, it would mean a lot to them. So I'm just wondering, is there any upper limit for an agency, and what if an agency wants to offer all of these? I guess I'm wondering how many people you're thinking of serving here, and how many of their, you know, I mean, some of them may have existing children that would need child care, or, you know, someone who's homeless, and you know, we have lots of people in shelters right now who might be eligible. So is there any kind of, you know, upper limit or plan that the agency anticipates for serving individuals, or, you know, can this all go to one agency or agencies? Or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, they would provide these services, or if they don't provide these services, be able to refer for these services. So the monies would be going to one entity, which would be the Positive Alternatives Program. And that program would then be either linking the pregnant mother to these services or providing the services themselves.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Well, those of us who serve on the committees that fund child care, or to deal with the folks that have lost their health care or lost, you know, many of these kinds of assistances, know that they're, you know, we're cutting those programs, reducing the eligibility. So just linking them to a service, they may not be eligible for it, you know, at all, because they're just a little bit above a threshold. Or so I guess I'm just wondering what kind of promises we're making here. I'm thinking of all of the testimony we had just in the Jobs Committee about people who've not been able to get child care, or who've lost their, you know, medical assistance, or, you know, the governor's plan to kick people off of Minnesota Care. They're no longer eligible. So an agency that may claim to do all this may find that the people that they're trying to serve are not eligible for any of those. So are they on the hook then to try to provide any of this, or is it just totally, again, a link, and if people aren't eligible, so what? But the agency still gets the money.
Ms. Wolverton.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. They would, if they're eligible, if they meet the criteria and are eligible, to be able to transfer. That is one of the beauties, I think, of this particular potential, is that you would have that opportunity of linking women who wouldn't normally know what those resources are. They come into a facility and would be able to find out, here are resources, we can check you for, what are the eligibility, and we can provide them with an array of options and get individuals into areas where they can find some help or some resources throughout the pregnancy, and once the baby is born, initially afterwards, to try to get them back on their feet. And so a lot of it would be around, when we review the grants from the organization that comes in, and take a look at how are they able to provide these services, what's their plan. That would be part of how we would review a competitive grant coming into our agency. with these few dollars, we certainly could not fund every agency with a grant to be able to do this. So a lot will be in the program and how they can provide these services and tell us that they provide these services. Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
I need to change some wording then, because on page 2, line 1, you've got necessary services include. And what you've got listed there, the promises of things you want to help people with, maybe also things that they are not eligible for because of their, you know, just being slightly above, and maybe they're working poor, very poor, but they're not quite poor enough. So I don't know if you want to call it necessary, because then it's a false promise, and I would think you would find a lot of people in that situation who might think they're going to get some help and they're not. So I just wonder if you've thought about that.
Ms. Wolverton.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, when it says necessary services included but not limited to, I say that those services are services that the agency would be able to provide or refer to, and not necessarily that every woman that walks in the door would be eligible to go to or get each one of those particular services. Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
My point is the same. I don't know if you don't understand it, but it's... referring people to an organization that they're not eligible for doesn't help them one bit. To a program that doesn't help them for doesn't help them at all. And that's some of the problems that we run into here, is that people are having problems with a lot of their families. They can't afford real basic services.
Representative Fulbert, anyway. To this point.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and members, on page 1, on lines 24 and 5, it says, "an assistance with securing necessary services."
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Clark, and then I should wind this up and move on to the next question.
I'll leave it. I think, I mean, the point is, some of that assistance will probably have to come go talk to the governor about the fact that he's made all these cuts in these budgets, or come to the legislature and have Representative Finseth carry a bill that makes people more eligible. I mean, you know, it's just I'm concerned about looking like we're going to provide this wealth of services and people just may be, you know, totally ineligible. So that's my point.
Okay, Representative Beard, Biskins, Earhart, and Kelleher. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Is it Wolverton?
That's correct.
Or Representative Finstead. These services that we're going to be referring to, and this may be a differentiation here between the way one side of the world sees things and the other side sees things. Medical care, nutritional services, housing assistance, so on and so forth. Are those always necessarily government-funded programs, or could they be charitable institutions that are outside of government funding, perhaps with private funding or people to do things from altruistic purposes?
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great point. You're exactly right with that assumption. To address Representative Clark's questions and concerns a little bit, and I think it dovetails with what you're saying, These grants are going to be made available for organizations that provide these services. We're not saying for organizations that provide these state-sponsored services. You know, the nutritional advice could be nothing more than one of these organizations sitting down with the woman and her family that comes in that's pregnant that needs some help with some nutritional advice or some housing advice or so on and so forth. It's not the assumption that they're going to come in to access more government services, I don't think, is the intent or the route that this bill is taking.
Representative Beard.
How refreshing, Representative Finston. Thank you. So what, just to be clear, what we have here is Ms. Wolverton, who oversees a budget that is going to take $5 million out of the next biennium, which, oh, by the way, is a portion of an increase, I believe, she's getting that's substantially more than that.
$2.5 million, actually, Representative.
$2.5 million per year.
Correct.
Well,
okay, 1 year in this biennium. Okay, my point being that Health and Human Services is getting an increase of substantially more than that, and we're going to ask them to take $2.5 million of that to help people, to refer people, and to link them up with services that are not taxpayer-generated in some cases or many cases. This strikes me as a pretty prudent use, I would think, Representative, of this kind of money. And as long as we're thinking about it, well, no, let me just hold my comments right there. I think that's far enough for this line of this point.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, a comment was made earlier during the presentation of this bill in questioning that tried to draw a distinction between a living child and an unborn child. Mr. Chairman, I and many Minnesotans that I'm aware of believe that such a distinction isn't possible, that an unborn child is indeed a living child. Mr. Chair, this is an important enough bill that I request a roll call.
Roll call is requested. Representative Earhart.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure. You almost have to require that an MD be in this process if we're going to decide whether a woman's life is in danger or her health, which is not indicated here. You might have a licensed practical nurse making that kind of decision if you're going to offer her medical care. That's one question.
Okay, Ms. Wolverton, you want to answer that one?
Yes.
Or Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick point along those lines. There's a national survey I was reading that talked about upwards to 80% of women that have had abortions state that they had their number one reason for having an abortion was lack of support or lack of lack of support, I guess, was their number one reason. So if you look at all the different options that this grant could go for, it's not necessarily the medical service of, you know, should I have abortion, shouldn't I have abortion, but it's the support as far as nutritional advice, educational advice, housing advice, parenting advice. There's so many different things that this bill addresses, and to the point of when it comes down to the medical questions, I think Ms. Wolverton answered that question pretty accurately along with Representative Bradley, as far as those that are providing those services are already regulated and licensed in the state and are operating under law.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Finseth, you are not specific. Medical care is, I just went down and talked to Representative Bradley, and I think I heard him correctly, that medical care could be a whole number of things, including if you are going to perform the services from a licensed practical nurse, that would be sufficient to say that covers medical care. I'm concerned about your phrase here, to prevent her death. And somebody then, if a medical person says, a doctor says, you got to have an abortion, now where are we then? We're hanging here. We're going to take the funds of this outfit away, whoever it is, because it's on page 232, line 32, and page 3, lines 10. You're either going to take care of a woman and her health, all her care needs, which demands a medical doctor, and if it requires an abortion, you're going to make a referral. God help us if you don't, and you let the woman die. Now, if that's not enough, we are going to, when you do that, make that referral, then we're going to take your money away.
Representative Finstead, do you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just quickly point out that these are not new organizations that would be eligible for these grants. These are organizations that have been operating, upwards over 100 of them around the state that have been operating for many years. So this isn't back alley doctrine. I mean, this is stuff that have been proven, and many success stories. Many, many success stories can be talked about in this area. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll make one more. You're not really addressing my question. My question is the health of the mother-to-be, or the life of the mother-to-be, and you're just baffle-gabbing me, and I don't care, so let's let it go. This is going anyway, and it probably would be, you got the severability clause in here, so that's probably what will take place when it goes to the courts.
Representative Bradley, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One, just remind that these services are voluntary. People come to these places voluntarily. Two, there is a clause in here that does say that in ensuring that none of these funds provided are used to encourage or counsel a woman to have an abortion not necessary to prevent her death. So there is a clause in here indicating that there's a sensitivity to the health of the woman that's involved.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Finn said, I think that your bill certainly addresses
what I believe is common ground, and that's preventing abortions. I don't necessarily like how it does it in a couple of regards. I don't like putting definitions into state law. I don't think we normally do that. So I'm going to voice my concern about that here today, as well as the restrictions on what type of nonprofit organizations can apply to counsel women in this way. I think that we all agree that abortion is a tragedy, but some of us would disagree about the availability of that procedure. And I want to tell you here today that I think that what would make this a much better bill is if there was less of this restrictive language on who gets this or the opportunity to apply for the grants, as well as a provision in this bill that talks about preventing pregnancy in the first place. Because I believe, and in my value system, one of the most important things here is preventing the unwanted pregnancy through comprehensive family planning. And we never really talk about that in this body. We don't want to talk about it in this body. And I wish we did talk about it in the body, because I think it's one of the other tools that can prevent unwanted pregnancy and some of the things that you referenced in terms of when women don't feel supported when they're pregnant. So I think that this could be a much better piece of legislation. I'm hoping that if we do see a return from conference committee, that it will be a better piece of legislation that'll do what you want it to do, but it also could be truly common ground around preventing unwanted pregnancy as well as preventing abortions. So, Representative Finstead, I think you're on to part of this, but we really could do this much better together if there was some stronger language in this bill around some of the issues that have been brought up about medical care, as well as less restrictive language around who cannot participate in this, because I think that no one philosophy in this world has a corner on the persuasion techniques of getting young people both to prevent pregnancy as well as, frankly, to help people carry a pregnancy to full term. So I think we could do a lot better if we were working together on this, but I know this is kind of like a rocket ship right now, and it's hard for it to slow down until it gets to that conference committee. So I think that there's some ways to improve this, and I hope you'll be open to those.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the points that Representative Kelleher made. I think the bill has some good points, and it could be improved. I wanted to just touch base, though, on the topic we were discussing a bit earlier, because I would not, in my own mind, want to frame this as a vote that would be either or, this bill or what is going on in the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program. That program has deep roots in my community because of a series, you know, of suicides over the years that, believe me, were very emotional, very powerful. I taught at a school where we lost 5 kids within 12 months. That doesn't happen without changing your attitude towards, you know, looking for ways to prevent. I have concerns from what I've heard from some of my constituents that while there may be federal dollars for which to apply, there is concern that the dollars are limited and they are structured as such to go to states that don't have programs. I would hate to see us be put in a position where we were cutting a program that is a landmark program, thinking we were going to be eligible for federal dollars that could not come to us because we had a program, but would rather go to those who were modeling our program. So, you know, for the vote today, I would hope everybody would keep in mind that the suicide prevention efforts in this state have been laudatory, deserve to be modeled, and deserve to be supported. And as we go through the budget process, when we get to the omnibus funding bill, I hope a lot of people sitting around this table think really long and hard as we make those priorities that that Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program or the whole Suicide Prevention Initiative is one that we should look for the resources and support. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment in response to Representative Beard's comment, which is I think both of us have been working on housing, education, employment, childcare, all that, knows that the private sector is a very important partner. It's not news to us. Didn't get invented today. Couldn't do it without them. In fact, we're relying more and more and more on them as we cut back. You know, we cut back on the public share. I do want to ask one question of the author. If I'm trying to understand on page 2, lines 31 to 34, a question raised by Representative Earhart. If I read that right, there's a couple of double negatives there. So I think I'm reading that to say that the funds can be provided to refer somebody for an abortion if there's a medical judgment that their life is threatened. So is that right? These agencies can or must refer for an abortion if the woman's life is threatened. Is that right?
Representative Finstead?
I believe that is correct. I was just trying to read it through here, but yes, I believe that's correct.
Okay. And how will that be monitored and determined? How is that going to work? Where are they going to be referred? Do we have... Are these agencies going to have links then with agencies that provide abortions for persons whose lives are in danger?
Ms. Wolverton?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, at this point in time, not knowing how exactly that RFP is going to look, but my assumption in this case would be that if they are ever able to refer for medical care, whoever is providing that medical care would be able to refer that woman on for the services that are needed.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark,
that agency then will get training or will be told in their contract that they need to be able to work with an abortion delivering service for a woman whose life is threatened. Is that correct? They need to refer her.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, it would be whoever is providing that medical care that would be doing the referral, not necessarily the agency doing the referral.
Well, Mr. Chairman, does the Health Department have an expectation that you would want that agency in their contract with you to know? I mean, they're being linked to all these, it says medical, includes medical care. Assistance for medical care, so that's medical care. So I presume, I guess I'm just asking if they then, I mean, I presume that you're going to have that in somewhere, and they're not going to just leave them. A woman comes in and determines her life is in danger, all of a sudden she's no longer, the agency won't help her at all.
Ms. Wolverton.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, once they're referred for medical care, if I go to medical care with a physician, I'm assuming that's between the physician and the client as to who they're referring to for that care. If I'm being referred for medical care, I'm going to a physician that that particular agency would be referring me to.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair will renew his motion that House File 952 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Knobloch?
Aye.
Dempsey?
Aye.
Abler?
Yes.
Abrams? Anderson?
Aye.
Beard?
Aye.
Bradley?
Yes.
Biskins?
Aye.
Carlson? Clark?
No.
Derman? Thorne?
Yes.
Earhart?
No.
Bradley?
No.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Dilty?
No.
Holbert?
Yes.
Huntley?
No.
Kelleher?
No.
Glunzing?
Yes.
Grinke?
Yes.
Larson?
No.
Mariani? McNamara?
Yes.
Nornis?
Yes.
Otremba?
Yes.
Osmond?
Yes.
Hamer?
No.
Rukavina? Bruce?
Yes.
Seifert?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Solbert? Sikora?
Yes.
Finstead? Vandeveer?
Yes.
Wiginius?
No.
Walker?
There being 22 ayes, or anyone want to change their votes who did abstain? There being 22 ayes and 9 nays, the bill is passed. And with that, members, we are adjourned. We will likely be meeting sometime on Wednesday. Watch for the notice.